Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, there's lots of activity in the bird world at this time of the year. It seemed like a really good time to bring back Bill Volkert. He's a retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist, worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years, and has been watching birds for well over 40. And so we're going to be talking about migrators a bit with you today. Are you seeing them in your area? What questions do you have about maybe feeding birds? Join the conversation. Give a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email or a photo to ideas@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. And Bill Volkert, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Larry. Always nice to be with you, even if it is somewhat remotely.
Exactly. You know, songbirds, they make a big splash when they arrive in the spring, but not so much in the fall. Why is that?
Well, it's kind of an interesting paradox because this is the time of year when populations are at their maximum. So we should actually see more birds because it's not only all the birds that came north in spring are heading back, but they also raised families of literally millions of young. But in springtime, they're arriving just as leaves are beginning to emerge. They're in their brilliant spring breeding plumage, and they're singing. So they call attention to themselves, and they're easy to see. Right now, this is really the peak of the songbird migration, and it's what I refer to as the silent procession. The birds are moving overhead. They're in the woods, but they're really quite reclusive and quite quiet, despite the fact that these are now the peak numbers. You have the adults, many of them that have molted or are in the process of molting, in other words, losing those spring colors and taking on a much more drab plumage. The young of the year haven't acquired those brilliant plumages. They have a different kind of a dull plumage. It's good for camouflage, and they tend not to sing at this time. Plus, the leaves are full, so they're really hidden in the forests. So it's a little bit more difficult to find them, but it still is a really spectacular time to go out and see what you can find, and they are there. Of course, we had some weather issues, too, with the persistent rain last week, and, of course, fall with some of its strong winds. That'll get birds to hunker down a little bit, too.
You know, one way to find a bird is through its call. I know they're not singing so much now, but I know Tyler's got a blue jay, I think, up for us. Tyler, you got a blue jay? Pretty typical call for the blue jay, right?
Yes, and that's one of those birds that I think everybody should know at least that call from, and they also got their name from that. It sounds as if they're saying jay, but these are very social birds. They tend to move around and sort of medium-sized flocks. They're a year-round bird for us. And if you listen close enough to blue jays, they have a tremendous vocal repertoire, just this incredible so-called vocabulary, real variety of calls. So some of them are just slight variations of the jay call. Others sound nothing like it whatsoever. And then they also have a very unusual habit. They can imitate the hawks. You'll oftentimes hear them imitating the call of red-tailed hawk, which they're really quite good at, but it just doesn't have that force or power. So,
And why do they do that?
Well, there's a little bit of a difference of opinion. We're not really sure. One common thought is maybe there's a food source and they're just trying to scare other birds off of that. who knows? Maybe they're just having fun and they're good at it because they can. I've also heard them do red shoulder hawk. That's another one they're pretty good at, but it's also weak.
And, we're losing you a little bit, Bill.
As I said, they also will do the red-shouldered hawk call. And then another call that they're really good at is broadwing hawk. And broadwing is just a real thin, like, whistle. It doesn't really sound like a hawk. And they are really good at imitating that. So they make just a variety of calls and own probably 15, 20-plus different vocalizations. So when we recognize the blue jays in a common jay call, just listen to them closely and just listen to the variety of calls, and some of them you may not even recognize the blue jays.
Bill Volkert, our guest, great to have him with us as we talk about birds. I've had a lot of questions recently that have revolved around owls, and I did want to talk about owls a little bit. There's a lot of variety. I think Tyler's got a great horned owl, for example, call. Let's hear that one. Oh, I think that's it.
Okay.
I was waiting for the second one, but I think that was it. So the great horned owl, lots of them in the state.
Yeah, it's a very widespread, very common bird. There you go. And yeah. That five note is the most common call. The females oftentimes will do a slight variation of a seven note call. And as we get into late fall and over the winter, we're going to start hearing a lot more of that. And they don't even need a very big woodlot for nesting. They, of course, do not construct their own nest, so they may occupy an abandoned crow or a red-tailed hawk nest, or oftentimes a large cavity, an opening in a big tree. And they're actually the earliest nesting bird in Wisconsin. They'll be on their eggs end of January, early February in southern Wisconsin. And certainly as we get into February, March, they'll be incubating. So they're going to start really tuning up here as we get into later fall. And you also will hear at this time of year, oftentimes the begging call of the young. It takes a long time for an owl to grow to full size and then become skilled at hunting and be entirely independent of its adults. And I suppose like some kids, they just don't like to leave home too quickly, and they want to beg off the parents. And so you'll hear this very wheezy sort of a call. And I'll do a lousy imitation here. It's sort of a wee, wee. And that doesn't sound at all like the hooting that we are used to. But I've had a lot of people over the years ask me, what is that sound? And, yeah, these are the young that haven't yet quite given up begging from the parents. And they'll continue well into fall.
What about the barred owl? I always like the barred owl.
Yeah, that's our second most common owl. I think probably great horned owl is kind of a spectacular bird, just that the ear tufts, what we call the horns and that face. So there's a lot of, say, illustrations and images of that bird. Barred owl, it's probably as common as the great horned, likes a little bit more of the dense forests. And it's a little bit smaller in size. It also has dark eyes rather than the bright yellow eyes. And that's the one that I think most people, it's one of the first birds that we learned the little phrase or mnemonic, as we call it, to remember the call. It's that four notes and then four notes again. Who cooks for you? Who cooks for you all? So, And they're calling now. The younger are tuning up. They're calling yet. They're kind of getting used to it. The parents are calling back and forth. And in some ways, they tend to be maybe a little bit more vocal than the great horned owl, especially throughout the entire year, I would say.
Well, we have a number of callers online with questions. Let's go to Chris in Black Creek first. Chris, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, hi, Mr. Mueller. Yep, Chris Zander, crystalsforkids.org. And Larry, I have a lot of people that listen to your show and they call me up. Hey, I heard you on the show. So I'd like to get a shout out to one of them, Tim Emerson. But for your guest, Bill, I leased 100 acres in Baraboo, Wisconsin, up at Newman and Tower Road. And I 2 years consecutively, and this was in the spring, I'd be sitting out there turkey hunting, you know, and there's a belt line of robins that come through there by the hundreds. I mean, you can't hear them. They're fighting and screaming at each other, and they're all heading north. Hundreds of them coming through in a belt line right in that spot. 2 years consecutively, I saw that, and I thought, that's pretty cool. Bill, you probably experienced that in your 40 years of experience, but so... So, yeah, I just wanted to throw that comment out there, Larry. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask if that's a common – I was going to ask Bill if that's a common thing.
Occasionally, you will find these concentrations of birds that are moving up In the springtime and also in fall, especially, say, among some of the blackbirds, they can form just incredibly large flocks and these big roosting flocks in our wetlands. Baraboo Hills is sort of an island of mature forest for southern Wisconsin, where a lot of our land has been converted for agriculture and subdivisions and cities. This is a really large, expansive forested area, so perhaps a kind of a target for some of these birds as a stopover and a feeding site and resting site in migration. And also, it turns out to be a very important nesting site for a number of birds of the deep southern forest for Wisconsin that are quite uncommon in other parts of the state. Birds like the cerulean warbler, worm-eating warbler, Louisiana water thrush, these are great places to look for those birds.
Interesting. Chris, thanks. Appreciate the call. Connie in Portage. Oh, we lost Connie. Let's go to Mike in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Well, good afternoon. I want to know how birds can tell the difference between north and south. I can't do it. Are those birds smarter than I am? Are they smarter than I am?
Birds are pretty smart in some ways, aren't they, Bill? Well, how does a bird know north from south?
Well, good question. It's probably somewhat different for different birds, or maybe some of the different cues that they use or what they're sensitive to may be more of a priority, say, for some birds than for others. But we do know this. There was a study done way back in like the 1940s using homing pigeons, and they could take these birds for hundreds of miles and just open the cage, let them go, and sure enough, by the time you drive home, they're coming in. And people wondered, how did they know how to do that? They thought maybe the Earth's magnetic field had something to do with it. So they actually took two groups of homing pigeons. One group, they put a little magnet on their head. The others, they put a brass plate, so that at least they knew that just having weight on your head wasn't going to be the interference. And sure enough, the ones with the brass plate came back pretty directly. The others seemed confused. So magnetic fields may certainly have some role in this. And as I said, for some birds, maybe it's more important than for others. It also seems an interesting phenomenon is that when we were training the whooping cranes to go south using the ultralight planes, take them south once, and they seem to remember where to go back. Well, occasionally they get caught up in winds. These are young birds, barely a year old. And what we found is there were birds scattered from, say, the Dakotas, Minnesota, all the way over to Ohio. And when we took a look, sure, they were off course, but they were almost exactly at the same latitude. They knew how far north to come. They just didn't quite remember how far east-west to hit the target. The other thing we know is that most of our songbirds migrate at night. And one of the most clever studies, at least in my opinion, was taking a songbird and, in a sense, preparing it, so to speak, for fall migration. We know the cue there is the shortening of the day length, or in spring, the longer days. And everybody knows right now, sunsetting a lot earlier than it did back in, say, late June and July. Our days are certainly getting shorter. Well, the birds recognize that, too. That's what's telling them. It's the time of year. You've got to get ready for migration. So they start feeding more, putting on fat. They're getting ready, and they get into what some people have called a pre-migratory anxiety or a little bit of a more active state, ready for migration. The day they leave seems to be the weather. So when the barometric pressure is changing and the wind shifts out of the north, that is the perfect condition to ride on. And that's what you're going to see right now, is that every so often as we get these fronts coming through, the cold fronts and the north winds, the birds that have been around your backyard are going to be making an exodus, and birds from further north are going to be coming in. Well, if you're flying at night, the question was, what was the cue? And they took the little indigo bunting, put it in a planetarium, had them in a cage, and if you can picture this, the cage had paper like a cone with a flat area in the middle, so the bird could jump up it but always slide down. In the middle, they had an ink pad. So he'd jump on that, get a little ink on his feet. They would project the night sky, and sure enough, the next morning, most of his footprints were to the north. To make sure that it wasn't magnetic fields he was responding to, they could rotate the stars. And sure enough, those birds were using the stars for navigation.
Wow.
And they even started blinking out some of the big constellations, and they found that the birds still responded pretty well until you started taking away the North Star, Cassiopeia, the Big Dipper. In other words, those main constellations and cues for the north, just like the sailors use. So we demonstrated they use then stellar navigation. Well, what happens when you have overcast skies? And this is really the thinking, is they're probably using multiple cues. If you're going south, keep the wind behind you. Follow major geographic features, the Mississippi River, the Lake Michigan shore, out west, the Rocky Mountains or the Appalachians. These are all major geographic features that they can follow. They can follow the wind, watch the stars, maybe the electromagnetic fields. Maybe if, say, the clouds roll in, they have a fallback for some other type of a cue that they use. One way or another, there's a whole variety of things they're doing. And what I always find fascinating is we're getting better and better at understanding what birds are thinking, how they respond to their environment, what's going on, but we can't ever completely get inside their head. And this whole phenomenon of migration just remains a mystery to us. And I think that's what makes it really kind of fun. We're never going to completely figure it out, I don't think, but it's great to watch every year.
It is indeed. Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, our guest today. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Ah, some cranes to bring us back to the show here. Larry Mueller with my guest, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator, talking about fall bird migration and birds. And that's a great sound to hear every year, isn't it, Bill?
Well, the cranes are certainly very vocal, and it's a big bird. They can really project their voices, so we can hear them from a long ways off. And they're starting to gather up in flocks. They're actually a relatively late migrant. They can hang around. I usually see big movements around Thanksgiving. But yeah, in preparation of that, right now, we're seeing them gather into flocks. So if you can imagine, they'll arrive in springtime in flocks. They'll then spread out and scatter, looking for their individual nesting sites, rear their young as isolated families. And once they start to gain flight, they look for each other and form these flocks, and they're now moving to areas where they can rest together at night, especially in some of the larger marshes, and have access to food nearby. So we're going to be seeing that over the next 2 months almost of sandhill cranes moving about, forming large flocks. And then as the weather starts to move in or get closer toward winter, and probably the big driver for them is snow cover. Once the snow starts covering up the food, it's time to leave, or even leave before that in anticipation. Don't wait till the last day. So we'll see them depart as we get into some of them leaving already in late October and throughout much of November, maybe a couple lingering even into December.
Let's take another call. Lyman in McFarland, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I have an observation about blue jay calls. We've been in our house in McFarland for 30 years, and there were no blue jays around at all for, say, the first 15 years or so. And then we started noticing an occasional one, and what was surprising to me was the call was just a very soft whistle. Didn't sound anything like I would associate with a blue jay. I grew up in the South, and there was a blue jay screeching in every tree practically. So anyway, this went on for years. Occasionally see a blue jay, hear the soft whistle. And then more than one blue jay started showing up in the yard, and you would start hearing the screeches. So my question is, it would seem that this blue jay screeching is some kind of signal to other blue jays, and I don't know whether it's a dangerous signal or a territorial signal, keep out. What do you
kind
you think?
Of thing. Thanks, Lyman. What do you think, Bill?
Well, good question. Well, we do know that there are some predator calls that especially birds like blue jays and chickadees will make. And we've even found that there is a difference between a ground predator and aerial predator. In other words, a stray cat or a weasel compared to a hawk. So if you've got a predator as a mammal on the ground, you want to jump up and keep a good eye and become very vocal and follow them. You don't want to do that when there's a hawk overhead. You want to dive down and freeze. And it turns out they also have an all-clear signal. The other thing between blue jays and also crows, they do not like owls. And even with hawks, which they see as a real predator or enemy, they will mob them. And I have more often found owls because of the mobbing calls, especially of crows. They just seem to hate them. There's just a real deep screeching, almost like an anger out of them. And you'll see crows coming in from all sides. Blue jays, they'll do the same, especially around, say, a Cooper's hawk. They'll keep their distance. That's a hunter, but they don't want him in the neighborhood. So, yeah, there's calls that way, and then there may also be calls between blue jays for territories. There's also a very unusual vocalization I only hear in spring. Some people describe it as a squeaky pump handle, if you can imagine, a little squeaky sound. It's a three-note call, and I think of it as saying, we did it, we did it. An admission of guilt, I suppose. I believe that's actually their song, because I only hear that in spring, so I think that's around their nested territories. But as we said earlier, a lot of different voices out of those guys, so just keep listening. It's pretty surprising what they can all do.
Yeah, thank you, Lyman. Appreciate it. John in Madison, we'll go to you now. Hi, John.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I actually have two questions. Regarding a bird species, when they have a variable range, including like a breeding range, a year-round range, and a wintering range, I was wondering how individual birds use that, if they kind of all shift down in the winter, or if the ones that utilize the breeding range kind of pass over and head to the wintering range. And then my other question is regarding whippoorwills in Wisconsin and their status. I guess I used to hear them frequently, but I probably haven't heard one in 10 or 15 years.
Let me take the whippoorwill one first. And, yeah, this is a bird that we've talked about before. It has significantly declined in Wisconsin as well as in the northeast, eastern states. And it also is a bird that it seems to, in Wisconsin, be shrinking in its distribution or range. In other words, places where we used to find them, they're disappeared, and the stronghold where we had the highest population is where they still seem to be holding themselves. That's especially southwestern and west central Wisconsin, a little bit up toward the northeast. So that is about it. I used to have them here in the northern Kettle Moraine. I have not heard one in years and years here. Well, I shouldn't say that. I actually had one probably stopping over migration about 3 years ago in spring, one single evening, heard them call, and that was it. They were never abundant here, but I would hear one or two. They're gone. And so that's a real concern. We're not quite sure what the cause is for that. But, yeah, it's a bird that, just from our observations and surveys, it has been declining. I'm not sure if I completely understood the question on the ranges of birds. Normally, when you think of range, it is the distribution of where we find them at certain times of year. So particular habitat types across North America, where those birds are distributed. Some have a very broad range. Others are much more restricted. And the same as in wintertime, whether they're going just to the southern U.S., into Mexico, or all the way to northern South America. So each bird has its own range. And when we have birds of kind of close cousin species, they have to distribute themselves to reduce competition. So a good example is the hermit thrush we'll find in central Wisconsin. Swainson's thrush tends to be northern Wisconsin, Canada. And then the great cheek thrush moves up a little bit more into Canadian spruce forests. So they spread themselves out so that they each have their own habitat and forest type. But it turns out the ones that go the furthest north are also the ones that go the farthest south. We see the same with the kinglets, ruby crown and golden crown kinglet. Golden crown will move into the spruce forest. Ruby crown will nest all the way up to the edge of the tree line, and they're heading farther south again. So this is a way for it's kind of the rules of nature for birds. That's why we have so many species. They've spread themselves out and reduced competition. Each one has its own little niche or its own role in nature.
You know, just in terms of birds and bird losses, birds not showing up so much, there was a study recently published that looked at how birds will do as the climate changes. I don't know if you saw that study.
Yes, I did. And I'm expecting I'm going to find that through other avenues here pretty soon. But I appreciate you sharing that with me. It was, a UW study and looking at interesting it was kind of a data analysis. So unlike other research, the researchers themselves did not do the field work. They just crunched the numbers and a huge data set using the observations of bird watchers, those that were posted on eBird, the electronic bird reporting site that Cornell University runs, and also using sightings of over 130 species of birds, and then comparing that with weather events. And what they found, and I think, you know, as I thought about it, is probably not too surprising, is that some birds seem to be more tolerant of weather extremes than others. And in a sense, this is also what we find when landscapes change. So as humans develop land, some birds seem to be a little more tolerant of the things we do to the land, while others, the more specialized ones, are the ones that just don't adjust that well. And the ones that have the hardest time, of course, are now listed as threatened or endangered species. And across the board, when we look at Wisconsin birds, of about 300 species of birds that would regularly occur in the state, we can divide up in about thirds. Those that are increasing, about a third of them are roughly maintaining their numbers, and about a third of them are showing varying degrees of decrease. So it turns out that whether it's nature throwing weather extremes at them, or if humans changing the landscape in the face of the land, some birds actually benefit from that, and others do not. And again, with weather, some are able to tolerate that much better than others. And so the point for this study really was is that if these short-term weather extremes were affecting some birds far more than others, perhaps climate change over longer periods of time would also have the same effect. And that can help us then to try to be prompted for which ones are probably going to need a little bit more.
Oh, we're losing Bill a little bit here on his phone. Bill, I we got the message there. I thank you very much for that answer. And John, I appreciate your call as well. Let's give Dennis in West Bend a chance to join in. Dennis, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah. I've been in our home 35 years in West Bend and never have seen a pileated woodpecker until this spring. There was one around we saw maybe five times over 10 days. And then not all summer, but then about 3 weeks ago, there was a pair of them that were around we saw maybe eight or nine times over 2 weeks, and now not again. So I read that they don't migrate.
Yeah.
Most of our woodpeckers do not migrate. In fact, the flicker and the yellow-bellied sapsucker are the two that will migrate. Almost all the other woodpeckers are year-round residents. Oh, I should also say red-headed woodpecker is a migrant, but the rest are year-round residents. About the only movement you will see is when the parents have raised their young and now force them to find new areas, they'll disperse to find their own woodlot. This is a bird that's actually been increasing. Years ago, I would have to travel to northern Wisconsin or along the lower Wisconsin River to really find a reliable population of them. Here where I live, the northern Kettle Moraine, we always had some, but it wasn't always easy to find. I think they're becoming much more common, and perhaps it has to do with food. I think emerald ash borer may be an abundant food supply for some of these birds. So whether there's a direct link there or not may be argued. Maybe a little bit more research is required, but I would certainly think that may be a factor there for some of these woodpeckers.
That is an interesting thought, Bill. Worth looking at some more for sure. Dennis, thank you so much. Nice to see pileateds. They're such an amazing bird, and I always enjoy seeing them. Stephanie in Portage, we'll go to you now. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Good. Appreciate your call.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I'm calling because early this spring I saw these blue and black birds, and I identified them as indigo buntings, and I've never seen them before. And I'm wondering, how can I attract them back or get them first time ever?
Yeah, they're beautiful birds, Bill.
Yeah, that is. There are very few birds in North America that have a color of blue, and I think they're appropriately named. It isn't just a light blue. It is a deep indigo, and as you mentioned, blue-black. Blue, of course, is a reflected color. There's no pigment that actually creates blue, so it depends on how the light is hitting it. And if it's not the right angle, they can turn quite black. Most people will see indigo buntings in the early part of May when they first arrive. They'll be hitting the bird feeders. and then they seem to disappear. What they're really doing is just moving into the forest, and as natural food becomes more abundant and available, they just disappear there. Some will continue to hit feeders throughout the summertime. There's always a few individuals that may do that, but it seems like most of them show up for about 2 weeks' time and then appear to disappear. The indigo bunting, being relatively small and a bird that likes to be up in the treetops, this is a bird that is sometimes hard to see, or if they're sitting even on, say, a power line, they'll look like just a small black bird because the light's coming from behind, not reflecting off that breast or the wings. So they're actually fairly widespread in Wisconsin. The way to find them in later spring and summer is you have to know the song. And it's a real rapid, quick up and down two notes. As far as attracting them, they're attracted to forest and forest edges. So tall trees is about the best you can do. Put out a feeder in spring. You might lure them in for at least a brief time when they first arrive and need the food. And otherwise, it's just good land management to provide habitat for them to nest and raise a family.
And I think Tyler had an indigo bunting song for us. Tyler, have you got that? That's a pretty song, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very quick, just rapid two notes, up, down, up, down, up, down, a little chatter like that. And as I say, once they more or less disappear from view, that's the easiest way to detect them. So people got to practice a lot of the bird songs.
Stephanie, thanks for calling. Christina in Glenwood City, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi there, thank you. I'm curious, when the birds leave Wisconsin and, say, fly to South America, do they molt again into bright breeding plumage and breed again?
No, good question. They don't breed there, but they may start to undergo the molt in that latter part of winter, which is so when they're arriving, they're in brilliant plumage. Some birds may go through much of that molt and then delay a little bit and finish when they first arrive. Most of them have their spring colors by the time they arrive. And this really has to do with the big question of why don't they just stay in the tropics? And that's simply because there is just so much other life down there. There's too much competition. So they can retreat there and survive while we're suffering a winter and a lack of food. But there's just not enough space and not enough food to raise a family. So they come up here for the summertime.
Very interesting. Thank you, Christina, for calling. I appreciate it. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Michael emailed that he's been seeing plenty of hummingbirds coming through Madison just in the past couple of days. What's the safest way to offer food and water?
Best thing for hummingbirds is the hummingbird feeder. And I would actually keep them up for a while. Some hummingbirds will linger into Wisconsin well into October, even November sometimes. There's always an odd one that will remain awfully late in the year. And, of course, that food becomes pretty critical for them. So right now they are filling up. They're getting ready to leave. Most of our hummingbirds are heading to Central America. So our one species that we have here, the ruby-throated hummingbird, that's its primary winter area. So, yeah, keep those feeders full. At this time of year, of course, we not only have large numbers of birds, but also the insects, a lot of bees and ants will get to the feeder. So rinse them out and fill them back up again, keep them clean. And, yeah, you can enjoy the birds as they're attracted to that food at this time, taking advantage of before they depart.
Eric emailed that they've had a female cardinal at their feeders for most of the summer who does not have feathers on her head. Eric says we jokingly call her a vulture cardinal. And wondering just what would cause this.
Cardinals seem to be one of the birds that is more susceptible to feather loss than others. Maybe part of that is that they're hang around our feeders and homes and are a little bit more easy to observe than others. But from my experience, I think they tend to show a little bit more of that feather loss more than others. What is really going on? We've attributed to feather mites as a parasite. That's at least one explanation. There may be other things that lead to stress in the bird that could result in feather loss.
the cardinal does not migrate. It's a year-round resident. Overall, it's probably a bit of an inconvenience for the bird. But, of course, if you haven't got feathers and insulation on your head in wintertime, it can be a problem. It's just like going out on a sub-zero day without a hat. So usually it's more of an inconvenience and a bit of a, say, a skin infection or whatever the actual cause is for it. But in wintertime, it can lead to some mortality.
And Lynn emailed to recommend a book for owl lovers out there. Owls of the Eastern Ice by Jonathan Slate documents a Minnesota man's work to conserve the largest owl in the world, the Blakiston's fish owl in eastern Russia. And I know you've been to Russia, Bill, but a comment on the Blakiston's fish owl.
I've actually never seen that species, though I have seen the hawk owls. Yeah, there's some really good conservation work out there and really dedicated people trying to help all around the world some of these spectacular birds. And I really commend all of them for their efforts. You know, we're such a rich planet with over 10,000 species of birds. Rough numbers, about 10,300 or so, depending, of course, which checklist you want to use for a count of species. But in rough numbers, around 10,000. Well, like we said earlier, people are changing the face of this earth. And, you know, whether it's climate or habitats, alterations and losses, some birds are being affected by far more than others. And everybody has their host of threatened and endangered birds. While we certainly need to make our living on this planet, to do so at the expense of these species and to lose them is really a loss, not just for the natural world, but for ourselves. And so with that, we really need these dedicated people who are going to try to find a place for these birds, figure out what the problems are, come up with some solutions, and keep them here so that we can all have at least the potential to enjoy them. And even if we can't get to all these places to see them, just to know that they still exist, I think that's pretty heartwarming for a lot of us.
Yeah, and that book again was Owls of the Eastern Ice by Jonathan Slate that Lynn had emailed about. Let's go to Jude in Iola. Hi, Jude.
Larry, thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, I have two questions that pertain to the fires out west. My first one is, does this influence the migration of the birds that are leaving from those areas and going to South America? And second, do the birds know way ahead of time that they can get out of these forests, away from these fires, or do they end up just dying in the fires?
Well, that's a good question. I think the fortunate thing as far as timing is that this is a late summer, early fall event, so the nesting season is done. They've at least raised their families. The problem is, of course, those homes will be gone for next year. So with the birds that are migrating, no doubt they're going around those fires. They're finding a different route to avoid that because it's obviously dangerous for them to even be there, much less even if a place is burned over and the flames are out, there's nothing there for them. There isn't any food or hiding place anymore. As far as getting out of the way of it, well, we certainly know that humans get the evacuation order, and for some people who hesitate to leave, we just can't get out of there fast enough. A good thing for birds is they can pick up and fly pretty quickly ahead of those flames. So, yeah, right now I think most birds, like I said, it's past the nesting season, so it's not an immediate danger, but all those acres lost of potential nesting site for next year and for several years to come, that is really going to have an impact.
Jude, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. Bill Volkert, our guest today, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. Always great to have him with us. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here taking a look at fall bird migration with Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator. Great to have him back, and thank you for listening in today. Lots of callers online, so I think we'll just go right back to the phones, Bill. And Reggie in Oshkosh up next. Hi, Reggie. What can we do for you?
Hey, I was just wondering, I have, you know, songbird feed out right now, but should I change my feed for the birds migration and then the birds coming in for, you know, fall, winter?
What do you think, Bill? Oh, did we lose Bill?
What we do have, though, is the seed that you have now is going to be important for those birds that remain in winter. And, of course, that is why so many of these birds are departing, because the insects are going to be gone in a couple of weeks here. So that's really driving the migration. However, it turns out that a lot of these birds are not just taking only insects, but also berries. And I would strongly recommend, if you've got a little area in your corner, native shrubs that produce berries can be really quite an attractant.
There you go, Reggie. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Mark in the town of Lake, your turn. Hi, Mark.
How you doing?
Good. Appreciate your call. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a report. Day before yesterday, we had a flock of nighthawks come and feed on insects in the field behind our house. It was quite a show.
Oh, nighthawks. Yeah, and this is the time of year, isn't it, Bill, for them to be?
Yes, it is. I'm glad he brought it up, too. I was hoping we could talk nighthawks. Nighthawk is a very close relative to the whippoorwill. There has been some decline in that population as well. But it seems that this year there was a really good migration through Wisconsin. It's normally the last 10 days of August and into the first, say, half or so of September. They're starting to dwindle in numbers now. There may be yet a flock or two coming through. But there were reports from people across much of Wisconsin seeing 200, 300, 400, some people over 800 nighthawks, large flocks. Other reports where people are just saying there were so many I couldn't count them. So perhaps that's reflecting a really good nesting season for them this year. And I was really happy to hear that a lot of people got to enjoy them. You'll usually see them around dusk. So during the day, they're just sitting in the trees and roosting very quietly. But as the sun goes down, that's when they'll be rising up. They'll be catching the moths and other insects flying around. They may be passing during the middle of the day. Some people have reported some really big flocks of nighthawks feeding with dragonflies. And that would indicate that they're both hunting some sort of aerial insect in these big swarms. They'll be heading all the way down to Central America. So, yeah, this is probably the end of the nighthawk migration, say, over this next several days. We'll probably see the last of them passing through, but it seems to have been a really good year for them. So that was really nice to see.
Yeah, Mark, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Tyler, did you have a nighthawk sound? So when you put several hundred of them together, you could have a pretty good sound there, Bill.
Yeah, it's just a simple little buzz. That's all there's to it. They're much more vocal in the springtime as they're moving north. But, yeah, it's not much of a vocalization. But, yeah, you'll usually hear that up overhead as they're moving through. In springtime, we'll see them coming up in about middle to the end of May.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it. Kim in Wind Lake, it's your turn. Hi, Kim.
Hi, how are you?
Good, appreciate your call.
I am curious. I am a wildlife photographer, so I do wildlife for birding a lot. So I'm out and I see a lot of different things. But what I've noticed a lot more lately is leucistic birds. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, some people refer to this also as partial albinism. Yeah, these are birds that have got patterns of white in the feathers, and it may be scattered anywhere across the body, might be sort of mottled or speckled, or kind of what we think of as piebald, so that there's sort of this mottled white throughout the pattern. It may also appear as white in the wing or tail feathers. And for those of us who watch birds, it can be really tough to identify a bird at a glance that has got this white where it shouldn't be. It is, of course, a bit of a genetic defect, you may call it, or a genetic cause for that. And more of it, I don't know. Maybe it's just simply what we call sort of the observer bias, maybe because you're looking at birds more closely, you're just noticing it. It can show up in almost any bird, just as true albinism, the total white, might show up in almost any bird. But we tend to see it most often in the most common birds. And I think that's just simply because it's the roll of the dice. And say if one out of every 100,000 birds, just pick a number, might show this pattern, well, the more common the bird, the more often it'll show up. So robins, blackbirds, Canada geese, these are birds that we tend to see it in fairly often. But, yeah, it's just a little bit of a different patterning. It's genetically driven and just showing that speckled white somewhere in the plumage of the bird.
Mm. Thank you again for calling, Kim. Ron in Madison, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Which species of native cavity nesting birds in southern Wisconsin need the most human help by supplying birdhouses, nesting boxes, nesting platforms, et cetera? And then a follow-up related to the western fires. Conifer limbs extend within 10 feet of this building, a 12-unit residential building. The arborvitaes are on our property, but the middle-aged white pine is on public land. So if any advice on preparing for the drought that could cause extreme fires like they're having out west?
Hmm.
Good question. I'm kind of rolling that in my head, and I forgot the first question. I'm sorry. Pardon me.
Which native birds, the cavity nesters.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Now, I'll go on that a little bit first. For cavity nesting, there are what we call primary and secondary cavity nesters. And all that simply means is primary cavity nesters are those that will excavate their own nest. Of course, those are the woodpeckers. And the secondary cavity nesters are those that will use something as either a knot hole in a tree or an abandoned or former a woodpecker hole. And of course, woodpeckers will not just make a single cavity for themselves. They'll oftentimes peck a number of them in trees, and then the female will finally select one of those. So there's always some left over. So how to help them? Firstly, is just good forest management. Leave some dead trees out there that those birds can utilize. And so that is really the best that we can do. And of course, in nature, there were always dead standing trees. I think one of the problems is we think we're always cleaning things up. And in the same way, there was an article recently in the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology newsletter about cleaning up your backyard for fall. Well, all those leaves that are lying around really harbor a lot of insects. And maybe it's not appealing to our eye or something that we're used to, but, you know, this fall cleaning is actually what's providing shelter for a lot of those invertebrates, in the same way leaving dead trees. Now, what we can also do is supplement where dead trees are not that abundant with artificial nest boxes. The bluebird has certainly benefited tremendously in Wisconsin from the bluebird box program. And we also find chickadees, house wrens, tree swallows, they'll utilize them as well. And, of course, sportsmen know that the wood duck is another bird that we've done quite a bit of work with for providing the artificial boxes for them. One that could really use a little bit of help would be tree swallow. This is a bird that uses those bird boxes, but has been showing some decline. Perhaps it is a loss of the aerial insects. That's just not as much food around there. But certainly providing a nest box, which bluebird or a tree swallow may use, is a good place to start. Plus, they're fairly easy to attract in open areas.
Regarding the second part, that's a tough one for us. I was thinking about that. Maybe we need to do a show on that whole area of how do you help your protect yourself from fires that may develop.
Right, and I guess I would say, yeah, do a show with a different guest on that one who's got much more experience or expertise in that to answer that one than I do. So I'm sorry, I'll have to defer to somebody else.
Yeah, I've read some of the fires out west. Part of it has been caused by climate change, and another part of it is by forest management practices that have exacerbated the problem. But I don't want to go any further than that because I'm not the expert for sure. So we can look into that and see what we can come up with. Ron, thank you very much.
And I should also mention that one other problem with it is that people like to live in the forest. And so what's happening is people live in these more remote areas with all the trees around their house in a fire-prone area. And that's really where the problem comes in, where if these are wild lands, those have always been natural. We let the forest fires go. Sure, they're exacerbated by the drought conditions and climate change. But when you've got houses in there, that's where it becomes a real issue.
Yeah. Bill Volkert, our guest today, taking a look at fall bird migration with him. Bill's a retired wildlife educator and naturalist. He worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years and been watching birds for well over 40 years. He's going to be with us right up till 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we will be back. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about birds with birding expert Bill Volkert today, retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. He's also a federally licensed master bird bander with the Bird Banding Laboratory of the U.S. Geological Survey. So questions about a bird you've seen? Do you have a bird feeder question? Maybe give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org. And Bill, let's go right back to the phones and to Norm in Oneida County. Norm, hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm afraid I have a negative question. Can you tell me how many birds are predated, killed by cats every year?
Oh, that is a serious concern. We can only estimate the numbers. One of the early studies was done here in Wisconsin. It was basically following a few feral cats to take a look at how many they were taking over a period of time, and then trying to extrapolate that for the number of cats that might be for each farm or rural area, and then kind of guesstimating that for the total number. We think it's literally in the hundreds of millions for North America and Canada. Actually cited that in a recent study as the number one human-caused mortality for birds in that country. One way or another, however you want to measure it, it is certainly an unnatural predator in North America. Our house cat is something that came from the Middle East and to be domesticated. And allowing those out in the wild, birds just do not have the instinct to avoid them sufficiently. The American Bird Conservancy has some really good information about their Cats Indoors program. And what I like about this, it isn't just the bird lovers trying to tell cat owners that you shouldn't allow your cat outside, but it's also looking at the life of the cat. And essentially, a cat that is kept indoors has an average life expectancy of about 13 years. A cat that's left to go outside, it's about 2.5. They get into fight with other cats, other wildlife, car kills, and coyotes, and great horned owls, and even some of the large hawks will take cats as a prey item. So it's not fair to the cats, and it certainly is not fair to our songbirds to allow them there, especially when we're raising them in totally artificial numbers and then allowing them to go out there. And if you think your cat does not eat birds, that is simply a myth. They are a hunter, believe it or not. Even that, you know, little cat sitting on the couch does have a hunting instinct that is bred into it, and they just have a natural instinct to hunt small rodents and birds, and there is a tremendous impact on those birds.
I keep my cats indoors.
and I would have to say, as everybody else should, it certainly is another impact, and it wouldn't say it is the only thing affecting birds, but in a more complicated world where we have pressures on the land with loss of habitat, we have climate change, we have a loss of insects perhaps from pesticides, we have contaminants in the environment, we've got birds that have got to make migrations of thousands of miles into other countries that have other kinds of environmental problems. House cats are just another contributing factor. And I should add one more. These are two things that we can all do a lot about to help birds. Keep your cat inside and then take a look at your windows. This is another thing that is completely unnatural, is to have glass where birds either see the reflection of trees and shrubs in or can see from one window to the next and figure it's a free passageway. And maybe your house only has a half a dozen birds a year that strike the windows. But let's add that up. All the houses in your neighborhood, all the houses across Wisconsin, across North America, it is, again, adding up to the millions. There's a very simple solution, and we've done this at our house. I just simply got an adhesive and just put stripes on the windows. I don't even notice it anymore. I look right through it. Most of the people that come to the house hardly even notice I have it on. And I got something from a Wisconsin company called Kaleidoscape. And they make a product that either goes on the entire window, or I actually had them cut it in half-inch strips. Whatever you put on your window needs to be at least 4 inches apart. So the birds, as they look at that, realize it's just too narrow to fly between. I have had, on average, about 6 or 8 window strikes a year. I felt terrible about this because I enjoy the birds around. I've gotten to some trees around the house, and here we had this mortality. I'd be sitting inside, and you'd hear that thump. And sometimes the birds would perish immediately by breaking their necks, or sometimes they could sit there stunned and fly away, but you don't know what the internal injuries are. Some of them may survive, some may not. It just isn't fair to them. And just a simple solution, just putting something visible on the window about 4 inches apart, it'll drop it to just about zero. And that's what we've done here. I feel great about it.
Norm, thank you again. Jerry in Prairie du Chien, on to you now. Hi, Jerry.
Good afternoon. Thanks for accepting my call. I've got two questions. One is the I have a two-peater just outside my office, home office window, and it's near bushes, so it's a safe place for birds. And I've noticed birds, regardless of species, sitting on one of the branches of that bush, apparently sharpening their beak. It's kind of the same motion you'd use with a knife on, if you were a whetting notion, or if you were sharpening a pocket knife on an oil stone or a kitchen knife on a steel. That's question one. What's that all about?
They're not so much sharpening it as they are simply cleaning it off, especially if they're eating berries. They kind of mash them. They get smudged on the bill. It's kind of like, say, for us, picking up a napkin and dabbing your mouth a little bit in the middle of your meal. Same thing they're doing. They're just cleaning it up. So they don't need to, say, have a sharp bill, but they like to keep it clean.
There you go, Jerry. Thank you.
And the second question is, we've got an old I'm still with you, right?
Yeah, okay. Go ahead.
Okay, we have a huge ash tree outside our kitchen window, and it's got to come down because it's dying from the emerald ash borer. However, it's because it has that heavily textured bark, it's a real attractor for nuthatches, for brown creepers, for woodpeckers, and at least we don't want to, I'm thinking of having, when the tree guy comes, leaving him, leave maybe 10 to 14 feet of the tree, which is going to be a safe area, because the other dead branches are over the garage and things, and so we can't have the tree there. But I want to leave, 8 to 14 feet. What do you think about that idea? Because I know, the birds really seem to be attracted to that heavily textured bark.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. There seems to be a little bit difference of opinion of what to do with the ash trees. I know some foresters advocate trying to thin the ash out so that the disease doesn't spread so rapidly. I think that where areas where it's established, like where I live, it came in a few years ago. I don't think we can keep up with it. I'm leaving it on my property here, and I guess my opinion would be, should I rush out and cut the ash trees now because they're going to die? So while they're standing, we talked about pileated woodpeckers, that perhaps there's an additional food source there. It's unfortunate that it's an invasive insect species. And we'll have to see a little bit. We also had the question about the cavities. Perhaps some of those trees will provide a bit of a cavity for birds to excavate in later. I'm still waiting to see. I don't know, because of the way the bark or the fibers of the tree are textured within ash, how easily birds will excavate in that as the trees slowly die and begin to dry out. So I'm just going to watch and see on some of my bigger ash that are dying now. I'm not going to be cutting them all down. I couldn't possibly keep up with it right now anyhow. So we'll see a little bit how much they utilize them. I know for the elm trees, birds will certainly utilize those and excavate cavities because it's a relatively soft wood as it dries up. The problem for elm, of course, it tends to rot around the base, so they get use out of it for several years and it tends to fall over. And I'll see a little bit how the ash trees behave as a possible cavity tree for birds.
All right, there you go, Jerry. Thank you so much for calling. Bill in Wrightstown, your turn now. Hi, Bill. Bill, are you there? Maybe we lost Bill. Let's try another caller then. Terry in Baraboo, it's your turn. Hi, Terry.
Hi. My partner and I were up kayaking in northern Wisconsin the first week in September. We took a day and went over to Hawks Ridge, just north of Duluth. And the previous day, they said well over 1,000 broad-winged hawks had gone through. It's just a wonderful place to sit and watch. And they have people there that actually identify the birds for you. And they have a tabulation that they keep track of throughout the day on how many raptors they're seeing coming through.
Wow. And where is it again, Terry?
Hawks Ridge. It's just on the north side of Duluth.
Yeah.
It's up that north shore of Lake Superior. I've been there in the past. What's happening is we got a lot of hawks that are breeding across Canada. The broadwing hawk is a long-distance migrant. Most of those are heading all the way to South America, and they don't like to go over open water. So if you can imagine the birds coming down across Canadian forest, and then they hit that north shore of Lake Superior, they just start following that along, and then as they get around the corner of it by Duluth Superior, they'll spread out again. Well, it's a bottleneck. And it's a great place to concentrate the birds and get a nice count each year. Of course, we don't count every bird that's coming down across central Canada, but it does give us an index of how they're doing from year to year. So it gives us a little bit kind of like an exit poll. It gives us a bit of a sample so we can see how the birds are doing from the different species. And for people who want to go there and watch and have the people, the experts show them how to identify them, it's a great experience. Also, there's another bird I would like to talk about real briefly, Larry, and that is the chimney swift. This is another bird that is of concern because of the disappearing of our aerial insects. And these are birds that nested originally in large standing hollow trees. Well, as the forests changed, they found a similar structure with our chimneys, where it got its name. And they will nest in large chimneys, one pair per chimney. But as they start to move south, they will gather into flocks and make these evening roosts in these old chimneys. And we do have a chimney swift working group in Wisconsin that is working with owners of these large chimneys, contacting masons and chimney sweeps to find out where some of these are, and also asking people to report if they're seeing some of these older chimneys that are hosting these migrants, chimney swifts. And the problem, of course, with modern buildings is we're just not building those chimneys anymore. We're heating with natural gas. We're not using the large boilers and so forth. So these old chimneys are kind of a historic relic, and some of them are getting capped, which excludes the birds, or even coming down. And there's been a number of spectacular sightings. I just heard a report here. I just read this recently. Someone reported from Lake Geneva, the old museum there, in a single evening, 1,300 chimney swifts came pouring in, and they'll do it right after sunset. So it'll be a big swirl, like a vortex, and they just dive into these. Another report was from Whitefish Bay, 350 birds going there. There are people are watching chimneys in the Fox Cities up in Green Bay and other sites in Wisconsin. If you're looking for something to do with the family, this is a nice outdoor activity in the evening. You can social distance. Try to find one of those neighborhood chimneys and just watch there right after sunset as these birds will be swirling and just pouring into there. And it's amazing how fast they can go into there. You can't even believe that a bird can do 50 miles an hour, slip into a chimney with hundreds of others, and not crash into things. It's quite a spectacle.
Oh, man, that's great. And Terry, thank you again for calling. I wanted to go back to the broadwing hawk because I think Tyler's got a broadwing call, kind of a loud
listen
screech.
Listen to it. Just a little peep is about all it is. Yeah. Doesn't sound like a hawk. Yeah, see what he's got.
I think he had it just over us when we were talking. There it is. There it is. All right. So
doesn't
the broadwing
like a hawk, does it?
No, it doesn't.
No, it's not that loud screech like we know of for a red-tailed hawk. So it's not a bird that we would normally identify by its call. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, blue jays are really, really good at imitating that. And where most of our hawks will make some seasonal movement because of snow cover or rodent populations, which will cycle with boom and bust cycles, or, of course, heavy snow. They're just harder to hunt. Broadwings make a long-distance migration. They'll go all the way down into South America. So this is a long, long flight for a bird like that. And speaking of hawk surveys, they have been watching the broadwing hawk and also a western bird that migrates all the way to Argentina, the Swainson's hawk. They bottleneck going through the Isthmus of Panama. And they've got observers on some of these little mountain peaks where they can count almost the entire North American population as they slip through that narrow little strip of Panama. And they've had counts of almost 1 million birds in a single day.
Let's take another call. Sharon in Lac du Fambo, your turn. Hi, Sharon.
Hello. Hi. Hi, Bill. It's been a long time.
Hello.
This is Sharon Riley.
Thanks for calling. Hi.
Yeah, no, wonderful program, as always. And I just have an observation, kind of a comment, and then kind of a question. This year was a great year also for red-headed woodpeckers, at least up here in the Northwoods. So I don't know if you noticed that in other places. But I observed them eating just loads and loads and loads of dragonflies, and we had just an amazing year for dragonflies as well. We had like a dragonfly eruption where they all the species of dragonflies that breed in northern Wisconsin kind of all erupted at the same time. So usually they're spaced apart. So that's kind of my observation, basically, was red-headed woodpeckers and dragonflies. I hadn't seen them eating so many dragonflies in the past.
Oh, that's curious. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, no, I have lots of pictures and I can share them with you. It was just amazing. And then they would take the fecal sacs out of the nest and travel around in the forest and then shove them into the cracks and crevices of the trees in my neighborhood. So it was a lot of, extra waste material, but the birds seemed to be recycling it by just putting it into the, so creating more insects next year, maybe. But the other thing, too, a comment, which I mentioned on the phone with the gal that answered was, you've talked about so many important, threats, that human man-made threats to birds. I think the one thing that's often overlooked is the impact of light pollution. Light pollution may not have a direct effect on many bird species. I think it does direct them as far as their circadian rhythms, but also it really impacts insect populations. And I would love to see someone do a really comprehensive study on flying insect eaters like whippoorwills and stuff and the impacts of light pollution in these rural areas. The more we develop out in these dark spaces, the more we're attracting insects to those lights, and they just get zapped, basically. Yeah. I did research like this. I did programs like this in Hawaii when I worked out there.
Well, let's get, because we're running a little short on time, Sharon, I appreciate your call. Comments from you, Bill.
Well, that's actually a really good point. And as far as birds are concerned, probably the biggest impact for lights, remember what I mentioned earlier, how they migrate by the stars at night. So they're used to a really dark night sky with these faint lights overhead from the stars for navigation. Well, our artificial lights, especially in the big cities, can disorient birds. They will sometimes gather around the large skyscrapers, flying in circles, or, as I mentioned a little while ago, windows. they crash into these skyscrapers. So what a lot of the big cities are now moving toward, Toronto did that, I believe it was Dallas, Houston, Chicago, a lights out program. People are burning lights in these skyscrapers because they think it looks nice at night, but nobody's working there for the most part. They shut them all off, saves energy, and the birds basically have free passage. And this has been huge. The birds tend to then ignore the buildings. They're usually flying a little bit higher. They're not disoriented by that. And we're not seeing the mortality of them crashing into these tall buildings. So lights out program has become another big one.
Yeah. And Sharon, thanks again.
What we can do to help those birds.
Definitely. Yeah, absolutely. A listener in Fish Creek sent a message, by the way, that for several years they've heard whippoorwills every night, several of them. Wonderful to hear them at a distance. And Susan in Gill's Rock emailed that she has found, this relates to indigo buntings, she's found that if you have the right habitat for indigo buntings and use white millet in your feeders, that will bring them in droves. She's been getting the parents and babies all summer. They come to the feeder. The feeder's in an open area. And so white millet.
Yeah, the indigo bunting is a small songbird, so the large sunflower seed is really a little bit too big for them to handle. Yeah, the smaller yellow millet seeds are pretty attractive for them. And so, yeah, that's a good one to offer for them, even if they only hit it just in springtime.
Even if they only hit it then. Well, Lee, in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, I'll be real quick. How many birds do we lose, who knows, to these lawn care services, what I call the, you know, the lawn Nazis and the people that use them, the lawn Nazis? You know how they are in towns, bouncing around on the lawns.
What do you think, Bill?
Well, that's how many do we lose? That's hard to say, but no doubt lawn is really a sterile environment for birds. There's certainly no shelter there. There's a limited amount of food. And then with the different things we apply to them that are oftentimes having an impact on the insects, we're either killing the food source or perhaps contaminating it. Yeah, it's certainly not helping the birds. And so there's other things we can do with a more natural landscape, rain gardens, putting in a little bit of prairie wildflowers, offering our bird feeders that variety of food from anything from hummingbirds to the millet for the indigo buntings and other songbirds, leaving up cavity trees. And as I said before, reducing the hazards, keeping the cats inside, doing something about your windows. You know, I would have to say this, if I can leave your listeners with any thoughts, is all these things we've talked about, we know that some birds are in trouble and some far more than others. This is such a richly endowed world with such an incredible diversity of birds. They provide just wonderful opportunities for us to discover nature and enjoy it. And, you know, if you think about it, we're the source of all the problems for the environment and for wildlife. And that's kind of sad. It puts the onus on us. I don't want to leave you with a sad note. I'll leave you with an optimistic one. We're also the only solution.
We are also the only solution. Bill, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Always Bill a Volker. Pleasure, Larry. Thanks so much.
Yeah, appreciate it. Bill Volker, retired wildlife educator. He'll be back. We'll talk with him again. It's always fun to talk with him. Well, on Thursday's show, we'll take a look at how the new Wisconsin Immigrant Journeys exhibit, and then we'll also look at Buddhist philosophy. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.